I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
For most of you, it's just an ordinary Monday. Back to work, miserable, you know, you're sitting inside an office, beautiful weather outside, and then you turn on the radio, and the hope is that you either learn something, get moved by something, react to something with great emotion, or have one of those aha moments. If I told you that this was the 30th anniversary of Full Metal Jacket, you would say, no effing way, it's been 30 years.
Yes, it has been. No, it has been.
Because over those 30 years, some people age well, some people don't. I'm of the latter. But someone who's aged very well is my main man, Matthew Modine. Who I don't remember having him in studio.
That's how you lighten up the guests right before we started singing them.
I remember we had an issue about bicycles years in the back, but I don't remember what it was. But Matthew, it's Boomer and Craig. How you been, buddy?
I've been very good, thank you. You're a very brave man wearing that Knicks hat right now.
Listen, you can't leave your team
Unless
it's the Mets, then you jump on the Yankees bandwagon in a minute. Yeah. You're a big Knicks fan. You go to a lot of the games.
Yeah, I feel like I've been bleeding now since Allen Houston was playing for the Knicks.
By the way, the Allen Houston contract is what started the whole downfall of our beloved franchise.
Yeah, but you know, the Allen Houston contract, he deserved it, and then he got hurt. What are you going to do?
They gave him an out, the exemption, and they didn't take it more. Yeah. How much do you hate Phil Jackson, not as a person, but as a president of our beloved Knicks?
I don't. I mean, hate is such a powerful word. I don't want to use that word, but I wish that he'd go meditate and smoke weed someplace else.
We call that hate right
now. Very well said.
He probably gets good weed. So, yeah. I mean, let us know where and when, and we can figure out a little kumbaya moment. Yeah. Like, of all the teams that you love, I imagine you're a Ranger fan, and either Mets or Yankees as a New Yorker.
Giants.
But it seems like the Knicks are your team. Am I right?
Yes.
And you go to umpteen games a year. Was there a point this year where you got an offer, hey, Matt, why don't you come to a game, where you said, nah, not today?
Well, I've been working in Los Angeles and Atlanta, so I didn't have to even consider that. But I did make it to some Ranger games, and that's always exciting.
Yeah, it's always exciting because they win.
They win, yeah.
More often than they lose. Are you a Carmelo guy, or do you wish that Carmelo would move on and go somewhere else?
I appreciate his game, but I've never felt that Carmelo was the right thing that the Knicks needed. You know, that what we don't have with the New York Knicks is a leader. You know, we don't have that person who... you know, if I can use you as an example.
Well, how about LeBron James? Or how about, I could think of a million guys, Steph Curry even, or Kevin Durant, or any of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, the way that the Knicks, when I grew up in Utah, so we had the expansion. We had, here come the stars from Utah, here come the stars. We didn't have a hockey team, we didn't have baseball. So when I moved to New York City, it was one of the greatest things that ever happened in my life.
What year did you move here?
1979.
Would that be culture shock?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Right?
It was
amazing. Times Square hadn't really been cleaned up.
No.
You come from Utah.
Utah.
To New York City. What? Yeah. You came here for work?
To study acting, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Came here by yourself?
Yep.
How old were you?
I was just graduated from high school. I was just 19 years old.
And your parents said, go ahead and go.
Your parents must be like, what are you doing?
They thought I lost my mind. Right. Yeah,
said, I'm leaving.
Yeah, my mom and dad lived in Brooklyn for a long time.
Right.
So they knew what it was that I was moving to. And
Had you been accepted to like the Lee Strasberg School of Acting, or you just said, a nickel in my pocket, I'll figure it out?
I'll figure it out, yeah. Because I knew that if I went to Los Angeles, it wasn't going to happen. There's just something, there was the people that I'd met from New York, it was such a powerful place. There was something here that called me. And then I got a job working in this restaurant, and I heard the waiters talking about Ibsen and Chekhov and Tennessee Williams and Eugene O'Neill.
Right.
And I realized
these are great writers and playwrights, Al, in case you know who they were.
That I wanted to go into a profession that I didn't know anything
about.
That
was the Yankee outfield from the 60s. Sorry about that. Yeah.
So what was the very first paid job you got as an actor when you moved to New York?
I think it was After School Special.
Billy's Got Pimples.
Amy and the Angel, which was a remake of It's a Wonderful Life with Helen, the girl that played Superwoman, Helen, not Helen Hunt.
You're looking at me. I have no idea.
I can't remember a name.
I was outside playing ball. You were doing your thing. I was outside playing ball.
So your first role was an after-school special.
Yeah.
And you had the bug. And then what was the role that you got discovered on that made other people say, we got to hire this guy? Was it a Broadway thing? Was it a commercial?
It was a film that Robert Altman directed that was a Broadway play that was made into a feature film called Streamers. And we won an unprecedented Best Actor Award. They gave it to the principal cast of
The whole cast got it?
Yeah, Best Acting Award.
And then you're on the map, then it's like, F you. Yeah. Then the offers just come flowing in?
Then it never stopped, yeah.
That's awesome. I've
been really lucky and blessed that
I'll tell you what, you hit the mother load with Full Metal Jacket, though.
Yeah, I did indeed.
I can't believe it's 30. Craig was talking about it. It's amazing, 30 years. I think my son and I probably watched it 50 times.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. It's one of those movies when it's on, you can't turn it off. I mean, you just get stuck.
How'd you get that role?
You got to thank if I read it right, Val Kilmer in some respects, right?
In some way, Val Kilmer might be responsible because I was in a restaurant. I was having pancakes with this terrific actor named David Alan Grier,
of course,
the comedian, and I was sitting in this restaurant, and there's a guy looking at me, swearing, saying really obscene things to me, and I said, David, unless this guy's got Tourette's or he's some actor, you know, studying a monologue, he's clearly telling me where to go and what to do. And he looked over his shoulder. He goes, "Oh, that's Val Kilmer. He's a really nice guy."
Now, is Val messing with you at this time? No, he was
really pissed off.
He was.
Yeah. So David went over and talked to him, and he waved me over, and I said, "Hi, my name's Matthew." He goes, "Yeah, I know who you are. I'm sick of you." And, you know, you'd done Vision Quest and Mrs. Soulful and Birdie, and now you're doing Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. And I said, "Look, I don't know you. I'm the youngest of seven kids. I've been fighting my whole life. If you have a problem, let's take it outside."
Yeah. Now, at that point, had you been a part of the roster for Stanley Kubrick?
No, I knew nothing about it.
You knew nothing about it.
You had to send in a videotape audition to Stanley Kubrick, and I hadn't done it, and Val Kilmer clearly had. And somebody must have told him
that you had been involved in some way, but really you hadn't.
No. And so when I left, I went outside because it's before cell phones. I put a bunch of quarters in the phone and called my manager. I didn't have an agent then.
Right.
In New York. And I said, "This guy just told me that I'm doing Full Metal Jacket. Do you know anything about it?" He says, "No, I don't know anything about it." I said, "Well, let's call Warner Brothers and have them send Vision Quest. And I'll call Alan Parker in London, who was editing Birdie.
Right.
And we'll have it sent over to Kubrick." And I got the job. Stanley Kubrick mailed the script to my house. To this day, I don't know how he found my address.
Val Kilmer thought you had it, but you didn't have it?
No.
And then because he said something,
you went out to the phone and said, I want this.
If the rumor said I got it.
I love that. You know what?
I better go get it.
That's the American dream right there, man.
That's crazy.
Did you know about the film prior to
I knew about it. I heard that Anthony Michael Hall was playing the part.
That's
Stanley,
the urban legend about it.
Yeah, he wanted all 18-year-olds. That's one of the things that, I mean, when I did Memphis Belle, I was playing the captain of a B-17 in the Second World War, and it was a real life role that my Uncle Wilder had played and received a Purple Heart, which is one of the things I want to talk to you about today. He had almost his right arm taken off. But he said one of the things they always get wrong with these movies is everybody's too damn old. He said, "When I was flying the plane, I was 20 years old, and my crew was 17, 18 years old on a B-17. So Kubrick said the same thing about Full Metal, about the Vietnam films, is that everybody's always too old. That these were, you know, 18-year-old kids.
I had no idea, no experience, no nothing. Right, thrown in the jungles
he'd
of
seen
North
Platoon.
Right.
As like, hey, Tom Berenger and those guys.
Those guys
are too
old. There's not that kind of experience.
Yeah. Now, I want to get to your uncle in a second for sure. Talking to Matthew Modine, it's the 30th anniversary of Full Metal Jacket. It's funny, I always viewed Full Metal Jacket really, you know, Billy Joel once said about scenes from an Italian restaurant, that it was two different songs, and he couldn't finish either one. He just put it together and it became this classic. Full Metal Jacket's like that.
Yeah.
There's the boot camp, and then there's, you know, you're in Vietnam War. And they're two completely independent movies.
Yeah.
So I wonder, when you guys did the boot camp part, you know, and the drill sergeant was an actual drill sergeant, and he was great. I would think, people talk about being character actors. Were you guys, like, in it? During that part of the movie?
Yeah, we filmed the movie backward. We shot the Vietnam sequence and then the boot camp.
Huh.
And Lee Ermey, who plays the drill instructor in the film, that's not my phone, the drill instructor in the film was hired as a technical advisor on the film to help get all the things authentic. And he carried that script around with him. He said, "This role was written for me." And there was another actor named Tim Colcheri, a wonderful actor, who was also a Marine, who ended up playing the door gunner, who's shooting women and children. I said, how do you shoot women and children? Easy, you just don't lead them as much. Right. That was the guy that was cast the guy that was cast to play the drill instructor. And Stanley wanted him auditioning all of the extras that were going to be in the boot camp sequences. And he didn't want to do it because he says, you know, it hurts my throat. I don't want to yell all the time. But we had to audition all these people. So Lee Ermey was always going, I'll do it. Right. He would get in front of the video camera and he would pull up all of those things, you know, that you could suck a golf ball through a garden, all that stuff, which all got added to the screenplay.
That's great. When did you guys know that you had that it was going to be special, as a hit? Like, when you're done filming, do you know as an actor, this is going to be stupid awesome
You never know. You know, I did this show on Netflix called Stranger Things.
For a while, right?
We just finished the second season. Yeah. But you never know. You work just as hard on things that are successful as things that don't work. You know, you're on a team, you play your butt off, you work really hard, and sometimes you have a winning season, sometimes you don't. It's not for lack of effort. It's just sometimes you're playing against teams that are better than you. You don't know why something's going to be successful.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt. Will you guys do something like they just did with the Living Godfather cast? They went out to the Beacon recently, and they had basically like an inside the actor's studio with, I think Robert De Niro was there, and Pacino, and Duvall, and they had them just kind of walk through the experience of being on the set. Will you guys do something or like a special video release about the 30th or no?
Well, I've got a diary that I kept while I was making the film. It's called Full Metal Jacket Diary. It was published as a book. It was then made into an iPad app, which used to be $15. And for the 30th anniversary, you can go, if you have an iPad, download it for $1.99 right now.
It's kind of like my book. It used to be $30.
It's in paperback.
And then I have some friends, Al Giordano and Steve Nardizzi, used to work with the Wounded Warrior Project. They're now working with the Purple Heart Foundation. And I wanted to do something for this 30th anniversary. So the photographs that I took on the set of Full Metal Jacket are going to be auctioned on Paddle 8, which is paddle8.com, to benefit the Purple Heart Foundation.
Paddle8.com?
Paddle8.com. The thing that's cool about the Purple Heart, which I didn't know till I started working with them, is that it was something that was created by Washington, George Washington. Was during the Revolutionary War, he created this Purple Heart for those people who had been injured in war.
Tell me about your uncle.
And so my uncle was flying. He was on his 17th mission. He was over Europe. He got hit by anti-aircraft, had his crew bail out of the plane. His co-pilot was shot up really bad, and he couldn't get out of the plane. So his right arm was almost taken off, and he landed his B-17 in a field in France with one arm. And it was a funny thing about it, because he was a Mason, and the doctor was trying to figure out where to cut his arm off, and he had that Masonic ring on his right hand, and he said, "Don't worry, brother, I'll save your arm." And in a field hospital in France, they cut his hips open and took pieces of bones and put his arm back together.
Wow.
Well, you talk about the greatest generation. That truly was. It said they sacrificed so much for all of us. You know, I was thinking, Craig and I were talking about this. When you think of Full Metal Jacket, I think really like a version like of a black comedy. You know, there were some really funny scenes in there, and then there were some really sad scenes in there, and some really eye-opening scenes in there. I mean, how do you characterize the movie overall?
I think that's very good, and it's a big part of, you know, Stanley Kubrick is oftentimes criticized for making very dark films, that there's not a lot of humanity in his films, but I think that what he did was hold the mirror up to society and said, look, this is what we do. This is what we look like. This is what war looks like. Instead of trying to paint it in some kind of, you know, pastel.
It wasn't glorified in any way. It was real. It was dirty.
Yeah. And I think that even with Dr. Strangelove, that the insanity of Dr. Strangelove, I can't remember the whole title of the film. It's How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb is the full title of Dr. Strangelove. But that's something that could really happen, you know, the things that take place and the absurdity of war, the doomsday machine, was something that was very real. And so he said he set out to make a dramatic story about nuclear annihilation. And he said that it was so absurd that there was no way to do it without making it a black comedy.
You know, I don't know this. I can only talk to you about it from an athlete's perspective, meeting a new coach. And the coach says, this is what I'm expecting of you. This is how we see you. This is what we want you to accomplish. Did Stanley, does the director do that to the actor when he says, okay, you got the role, this is what I'm trying to get across?
Yeah, he was amazing. I mean, he'd clearly read the acting books. You know, he knew about the Strasberg method. He knew about Stanislavski and Stella Adler. But he gave me some of the best directions I've ever received in my life. One time we were walking through a field and getting ready to get into a fight, you know, in a combat situation. And he came over and he whispered in my ear, he said, act scared. You know, it's like the perfect direction because it's so specific. And then there was another time I did a scene, and at the end of it, he said, Matthew, you're not going to do it that way, are you? And he's like,
sorry,
I don't know what I was thinking. Yeah, I'm not going to do it that way.
It's about the duality of man, right?
Yeah.
Right, the duality of acting, I guess.
One of the things people should know about Stanley Kubrick is he wasn't British, because a lot of people think, because he was living in England, that he was British. But he was a Jewish kid from the Bronx. They wanted to make movies. And
give me a famous role that you turned down.
Oh, there's a couple. The one that's most famous that people like to talk about is Top Gun. But the one
that one went to Val Kilmer.
Yeah. No, it was for Tom Cruise's part.
Really?
Yeah. Maverick.
And you turned that down? Wow.
I did. Yeah, I didn't like the script. I don't think I would have fit in the plane anyway. You have to be about 5'5 or 5'6.
Yeah, but we can't argue with the casting of that one, though. I mean,
Tom Cruise is fantastic in the film, and he felt that it was a film about, personal best and individuality, and I've read that that's what, and so that was the right thing. The another one was Back to the Future, but they had just fired Eric Stoltz, who was playing the part, and they asked me to replace Eric Stoltz. And I thought, well, I'm too close in temperature to why did you fire Eric Stoltz? And they say that Steven Spielberg's first choice was always Michael J. Fox. And you can't imagine anybody but Michael J. Fox playing that part. I mean, it was written for him. The one that I turned down that was really, really stupid was Big. And my wife begged me to do that movie. Yeah,
The Tom Hanks role.
The Tom Hanks role.
And
yeah,
you turned
really
that
stupid.
Down.
Yeah.
Who's giving you this advice? Yeah. You turned down $3 billion entities. This makes me so upset.
Yeah, it makes me upset too. But you know what? You live and learn.
Yes.
Okay,
I'm happy to say, I got a movie in the theater right now, and I hope you'll go see it, 47 Meters Down, about sharks. We've been in the top five the last 2 weeks.
Are you at IPIX, in one of those places?
47 Meters Down. It's about these two girls come on my boat. I put them in the water, put some blood in the water so sharks will swim around, and they, in a cage so that they can see sharks. And what happens? The cable breaks, and I drop them 47 meters down or 150 feet down to the bottom of the ocean. And from that point on, it's like gravity. It's like these two people with a bottle of air on their back, 50 minutes of air, and 150 feet of water above them that's full of sharks. What do you do? It's really good. It's a really scary movie.
You push your friend out first and then, good luck. I would go see it with me.
If Craig and I were in the cage together, I would definitely throw him out of that cage first.
He would bear hug me and show me the sharks.
Well, the sharks may not go after you, man. They may look at you as like a whale.
Before I let you go, because I have like a bunch of
breaks. It's a whale. We can't go after that.
That's funny. Thanks, Fred Moore. Do you ever go to a public theater to watch your own movie?
Yeah, I saw 47 Meters Down in Westwood, Los Angeles.
You just walk in normal, buy a ticket, go in?
Yeah, it was so much fun. Listen to the audience scream.
Anybody recognize you when you go in there? Or you go
Modine's
in
to overacting again. Yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, no.
You go in disguise or just kind of walk in? And
just go sit in the back and watch the movie.
So nobody says anything. Yeah. Anybody recognize you?
Sometimes.
You go in during the credits, get some popcorn.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I just go outside the Lincoln Tunnel. I'm on there. Me and Phil Simms are on a big billboard.
Yeah.
And I go past the billboard and I look out the window to see if anybody notices that I'm in the car next to them.
Yeah. And are you still riding the bicycles?
I still ride the bicycles. Yeah. I was really happy. The Bicycle for a Day organization that we worked with a whole consortium of people in New York to help get the safe routes to school, bicycle lanes, the bike share program.
Do you like the city?
The only safe route on a bicycle is the West Side Highway. That thing is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
But even that really isn't that safe either.
Yeah. I'm really happy about all the accomplishments, and then there's parts of it being a New Yorker that I'm really upset about, because there's a lot of people that misbehave on bicycles. They don't obey the traffic laws, and people get killed, and pedestrians get hit by bicyclists. New York is a wonderful negotiation. It's one of the beautiful things of watching people go down and walking on the sidewalk and not bumping into each other, not getting in fist fights. It's a beautiful thing, but there's some stupid bicyclists out there that
What's the pin on your jacket there?
That's the Purple Heart. Yeah, that's the Purple Heart Foundation. I brought you guys a couple.
Here's my final question for Matt Modine. Yeah.
Thank you.
I've never asked you this question in all the times we've talked to you. When you're doing Vision Quest,
yes.
Does Madonna come to the set?
Which just came out on Blu-ray.
Okay.
Yeah.
They still have Blu-ray?
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're doing Vision Quest and you're a young, hot teenage actor, and Linda Fiorentino, if I'm not mistaken, is the
Carton
woman.
Just
right?
called me a young, hot teenager.
You're a young, hot teenager.
And back in the day.
Here's the question. Does Madonna come to the set and say, "You are mine"? And does she sing crazy for you to you?
She was dating Jelly Bean Benitez at the time, and right. I think that she wanted to marry him. And they were fighting. They were having a big lover spat while they were on the set. And she didn't really give a hoot about anybody that was there except Jelly Bean Benitez. Right. She wanted to sing her two songs and get the hell out of there. And, you know, in those days, she looked like Boy George. She had that kind of similar Boy George, the way her hair and the whole look.
Did you memorize the lyrics, though? Crazy for you.
What year was that movie?
That'd be 80, what, 5?
6, I think.
86, something, yeah.
Yeah, I'm crazy.
I just remember I got drafted in 84, got picked up by Peter King. You know who that is, the writer for NBC or Sports Illustrated? And I'm playing in my Walkman Madonna tape. And
he's like, who's that? Like a Virgin, right?
No, I was playing Borderline.
Borderline.
Yeah, and he's like, what's this? I said, this is going to be the next big thing to hit the music scene. Yeah. And her name's Madonna. And Madonna. Sure enough, man, she...
Yeah. So
it.
Madonna was in my movie, and then by the time Crazy for You became a number one hit,
right?
Yeah.
The movie got changed. The foreign title to the movie became not Vision Quest, but Crazy for You.
Did
and people would come up to me and say, "Oh, you're in the Madonna movie."
See?
So yeah, that's
well,
how,
listen, it's good seeing you, man.
It's great seeing you.
It's great that you're supporting the Purple Heart Foundation. You can go to paddle8.com and check out some of the great black and white photos from. Full Metal Jacket. It's Matthew Modine. You can see him on a big Netflix show right now as well. And anytime, we'll have to have you come back. We'll see you in the game,
man,
for sure.
Full Metal Jacket, 30 years. I can't believe it.
We're all getting older.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.